This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
The Pure Hoops podcast is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. The Pure Hoops podcast most definitely does reflect the views of our management. Here's three-time NBA champ BJ Armstrong and Eric Newman.
Welcome to the Pure Hoops podcast. It's June 11th, 2020, exactly 3 months to the day from when the last NBA games were played. Since then, more than 115,000 Americans have died due to coronavirus. One death in Minneapolis at the hands of police and other similar cases have brought on energetic protests and a meaningful conversation on racism and police brutality. NBA players and others around the league have added their names, voices, and ideas to the national discussion. And the NBA has announced the structure of a plan to return to play starting at the end of July in Orlando. BJ Armstrong and I will get into all of those topics with our guest, Howard Beck. We'll also discuss the oral history he put together for Bleacher Report on the 2000 Western Conference Finals between the Lakers and the Blazers that launched the Kobe Shaq dynasty. Here's that conversation with Howard Beck. Hope you enjoy.
Well, BJ, as I always like to say, it's special when you can bring a friend of the program onto the show. And you know how I feel about all of these basketball relationships I've been able to cultivate over the years. This one's super unique. I'd like to welcome back the one, the only, Mr. Howard Beck. Howard, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing all right. I'm glad to be the one and the only because I wouldn't want anybody else to be confused with me or have to carry the burden of being some other Howard Beck. So.
Well, there is only one Jelly Bean Beck, and that is you, my friend.
Appreciate that.
Before we dig in, it's been a crazy week, obviously, all over a crazy couple of weeks all over the country. You being in New York and Brooklyn, everything good by you? Everything calmed down a bit?
I'm not hearing helicopters, you know, like 24 hours a day outside my window anymore. So that's probably a good sign. The sirens are still fairly constant, and it's hard to know whether that's COVID related, whether that's protest related, or whether that's just other general New York stuff. But I mean, yeah, obviously it's been a strange few months, a intense couple of weeks. But in some ways, I feel like an encouraging couple of weeks, too. You know, the masses of people that have been out marching in my neighborhood and others around here and around the country, around the world, if there's any good to come out of all this, it's that everyone seems to be focused pretty squarely on this issue now of police brutality, of social justice, of racial justice. And the more I see people out there in the streets and using their voices and you know, we can get into the NBA's role in this too, but I mean, the number of pieces I've seen written or just the number of players and coaches and former players, former coach, I mean, everybody is squarely focused on this. And I just, to me, I'm going to try to be an optimist and feel like, you know, maybe this is a turning point.
Yeah, absolutely. And before we get to the run-up of the return of the league, you know, the league, of course, always ahead of the game, it seems, on this issue compared to other leagues and other sports. But obviously, as a society, country, and a culture, we've been way behind on this issue. How do you think the NBA now is collectively trying to go about being a positive voice here, a voice for change? And, you know, who do you see emerging at the forefront?
Well, it's interesting because right now it's not collective by the NBA. Maybe it's because they're all scattered and we don't have an active season going on right now because we are still in this state of suspension. So there's not a cohesive NBA approach to this issue right now, nor necessarily team by team. What we see is just a lot of, you know, individual efforts, whether it's players writing in the Players Tribune, whether it's, you know, Jaylen Brown driving from Boston to Atlanta to go march in his hometown, or, you know, Tobias Harris or Steph Curry and Klay Thompson. I mean, we've seen players you know, in every market and all across the country, just exercising their voices and making themselves heard. What I'm curious about is whether that will eventually coalesce into something that's more of a cohesive campaign by the NBA. And I think it probably will. Knowing the league as we do, they've got so much else on their plate right now, just trying to get the league started again with a lot of obstacles, a lot of challenges to getting going in Orlando by the end of July. And so I think that that's taking up a lot of energy and a lot of headspace for everybody who works in the league, whether it's in the league office or with individual teams. But I do think I would be surprised if there's not some sort of attempt by the league or a campaign, fostered by the league to channel all this energy and all these voices into a what could be a pretty powerful, group effort across all 30 teams once the league resumes.
You know, Howard, one of the things that, you just touched upon, could you give us what does it take the temperature or kind of give us an update on how will they actually execute this? You know, talking about going to play down in Orlando. And can you give us an update on how or what that could possibly look like?
Well, you probably will know more than I do and sooner than I will, BJ. But the setup, it's clearly they're straddling a fine line, right? Because safety has to come first. The reason the league was suspended in the first place was because there was a global health crisis with this coronavirus, and that has not gone away. Though some people are acting like it has, it's still a threat. It is still a concern, and it is still the most important thing for the league to navigate. You know, all the other things aside, the structure of the league and the number of games played and the playoffs and all these play-ins, all this stuff is secondary to safety. And so they need to create this virtual bubble, but at the same time, they have to be sensitive to the fact that people are going to go into this and have to be there for potentially 3 months and, do not want to feel like they're prisoners of the league or of Disney for that time. So it's tough. If you make it too much of a passive bubble, then you are running the risk of the virus being introduced into the NBA ecosystem. And if it's too strict, then it's tough for guys, and guys may not want to do it. We're already hearing reports of, and I'm not surprised, that there are players who are now conferring with each other about whether this is the right way to go, whether it's worthwhile. These are tough issues, but the only way for the NBA to do this and do it successfully and to finish this season and to crown a champion is to do it in a way where the coronavirus does not derail the whole thing. And it's not just about the players, who are obviously generally younger and in great health and probably not as susceptible, but hey, there's a lot we don't know about this virus, and it has killed otherwise healthy people in their 20s and 30s. But you also, of course, have coaches, some of whom are older. You have team staffers, some of whom are older. You got a lot of people who may not even know what their own underlying vulnerabilities are, because sometimes you don't know what they are until you've already caught something that has caused harm. So it's tough. I mean, I still think there's a chance this doesn't happen. I think it probably will happen, but I think it'd be crazy for anybody to predict that this is all a certainty and will come off without a hitch.
I'm glad you said that, because the margin for error here is so slim. There are so many factors at play that, my brain hurts to even think about it. And then you think about the basketball aspect of this, right? We've been out of it for 3 months. One of the beauties of playoff basketball is that journey through the season, that chemistry, the mission the top level teams are on that makes playoff basketball so special. Now we've had that pause. Momentum's gone. Chemistry is kind of hibernating. And you don't know what guys have been doing. We've heard all the different stories about guys who have had access to places, guys who haven't shot a ball in 2 or 3 months. So, we've got 7 weeks till games resume. Individuals are starting now, and we see the runway that's being proposed as far as, team practices and getting this going. I mean, is there any way to predict what kind of quality of play we're going to see on the floor?
I'm afraid it's not going to be very good, Eric. At least to start. I mean, imagine turning on the playoffs one day, the NBA playoffs, where, as you put it, you're seeing the teams at their absolute best, the best teams, the best players playing their sharpest with their best chemistry, their best rhythm, all of that, their best timing. But imagine instead those playoffs are starting in November of a normal year, when teams have just gotten back together for a couple of weeks. And instead of it being, oh, we're working out the kinks in these first 10 games of the season, we're trying to figure out who we are and our identity, our chemistry. No, those are playoff games all of a sudden. And worse, as you noted, this is the longest layoff guys have ever had without even being able to train or even shoot. It's not a normal off season. It's not like a lockout situation like we had in 2011 or in 1998, because at least at those times, guys could still go play pickup. Guys could still go to gyms and work out. Nothing has been open, not team facilities, not local gyms down the block, I mean, everything. So the ramp up is going to be a lot tougher. I don't know what these teams are going to look. I mean, nobody does. This is the great mystery on the basketball side of it. Putting all the virus stuff aside, what is anybody going to look like when we finally see them back on the court, presumably on July 31st? I don't know. I tend to think it's going to be a little messy at the beginning. You just hope nobody gets injured, or that there are minimal amounts of injuries from trying to speed this thing up and getting back to basketball. But I got to think that there's going to be a deficit there on the basketball side. And on top of that, without fans in the building, it's just going to change the atmosphere. And who knows what kind of effect psychologically and physiologically that has on the game, because you're just not playing in the same kind of environment.
Yeah, that was going to be the next point I bring up. And, BJ, you know this better than anybody from playing in the old Chicago Stadium. Howard, you know this from covering the Lakers back in the day during their three-peat, which we'll get to in a moment. But the home court advantage and the environment and the buzz and the rush of that, this is going to be more of a summer league environment. I mean, Howard, I read somewhere that they're talking about bringing the courts, the actual flooring, down to Orlando, and the home team, higher seed, having their own floor down there. Is there any truth to that? And how do you see the home court advantage being a non-factor now as we're going into these playoffs?
I'm skeptical that they're going to be bringing in the hardwood from the various arenas.
I don't think the parquet is going to travel very well down to Florida. You?
I mean, it's asking a bit much. I think what they probably could do, and I'm guessing here, it's just off the top of my head, I would think they could at least find a way to provide the kind of on-floor signage, the various logos of the various teams, and even maybe the baseline designs and all that. Maybe they can do temporary versions of that, slap it down. But the problem is that the way they make those things these days, they're seamless, so that it's not causing any problem with your footing. Sure. And if these are decals and things, then it might get a little bit sketchy. So I don't know. I cannot imagine they're going to have 22 different floors from the various arenas there. That seems like too much effort. The bigger thing is the crowd and the lack thereof, because without a crowd, there is no home court advantage. And, home court advantage is somewhat about the facility, somewhat about your floor or your whatever, just familiarity. But a lot of it, of course, is just the atmosphere. It's the fans. And there are ways they can possibly try to simulate that, but it's all going to feel as fake as it is if it's just piped in. So, how that impacts the game, I've said this a few times in the last couple of weeks. If you're a one or two seed, even a three seed, you should not need home court advantage to beat anybody in the first round anyway. So I think it's irrelevant there. Where it becomes an issue potentially, or does become an issue, is certainly conference finals and then finals, where that home court edge is, you know, often decisive or can be. You know, talent usually wins out in this league, but we've certainly seen any number of game sevens over the decades that are, you know, some of the most memorable games any of us have witnessed, that, you know, the participants will tell you, yeah, if this game was back at our place, you know, would have gone the other way. I mean, it matters. And there's been studies of this, of how the home court edge matters in the NBA. It can't be dismissed, but I also think it can't be really simulated. The ideas that have been floated to try to make up for it with extra possessions for the higher seed or extra fouls or whatever, I think are silly. That messes with the integrity of the game.
Sure.
I think this is a case where you just got to say, you know what? Tough. Sorry. It's just not going to apply this year. It's an unusual year. You're fortunate just to get this thing back going and to finish it out.
You know, Howard, by all accounts, just listening, you know, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I have to ask, what do you think this is the correct thing to do for the NBA to try to come back and play?
I mean, that's a really tough one, BJ. I mean, I'll say this. I would not want to be in Adam Silver's shoes. I would not want to be in the shoes of the team owners, of the players, of the union. This is a really difficult decision for them all to make. You know, on the one hand, there is still a global pandemic ongoing, and there are risks associated with it. And the result of this resumed league, how it's going to play out, whether that's worthwhile, on some level, it feels like maybe it's not. Maybe you should just put this off. But there's hundreds of millions of dollars at stake too, and you know that is a huge, huge part of this. It may be the only important part of this, aside from the virus itself. That's what they're really weighing. They're weighing the health concerns against the business concerns and the ability of this league to survive this period, because every game that you play is that many more millions back in the coffers. It's going to be a loss regardless, right? Because we wiped out a bunch of, you know, a few months of season, and they're not making up all those games. So regardless of what they do in Orlando, the league is going to have lost probably hundreds of millions in this calendar year. It's going to affect the salary cap. It's going to affect budgets for next season. It's going to affect all kinds of stuff. So what you're doing by bringing 22 teams instead of 16, which is what I think they should have done, but it's easy for me to say, but you bring more teams, you have more games, you reduce the losses that much more because those are games that are generating revenue. Whether they should or they shouldn't, I feel like is just a question that's beyond me. I think this is going to be somewhat uncomfortable. I think we're all going to be kind of holding our breath. Like, let's just hope nobody gets sick. Let's hope especially that some of the older coaches like Mike D'Antoni or Greg Popovich, Alvin Gentry, that they don't catch this because the league decided to, I don't want to say rush into this, but the league decided that they needed to do this. Whatever regulations they come up with, and we'll know them soon, I'm sure they're going to be well thought out. I'm sure they're going to be thorough, but nothing is perfect. And let's be clear, there is risk involved here.
And Howard, real quick, 22 teams, just talk us through how this abbreviated kind of play-in return would be and how this works with getting it back to the 16-team playoff.
Yeah, I mean, look, in all likelihood, we're going to see the same eight teams in the East. They're only bringing one extra Eastern Conference team, the Wizards, and then in the West, you've got five teams beyond the teams that were in the top eight spots when the season was suspended. Everybody's going to play, to our knowledge at this point, and things are still a little bit fluid. Everybody will play eight games as kind of a ramp up. Those will be they're kind of referring to them as seeding games. I don't know if those are. They're not playoff games. They're not regular season games. They're you know, it's like this little mini tournament, but those wins and losses will accrue to the standings as they stood. So if you were on the outside looking in, if you're the Portland Trail Blazers, you can make up that ground on the Memphis Grizzlies and displace them as the eighth seed. But then trying to remember what the gap has to be if you're within four games of the eighth seed. Two games, whatever it is, I can't remember the exact details. Then there'll be this, quick play-in where the ninth seed would have to beat the eighth seed twice, but the eighth seed would only have to beat the ninth seed once. It's all confusing.
Sounds like the old hoop it up 3-on-3 tournament rules in the once you're in the losers bracket.
Look, the bottom line is this. I won't say that I don't care who gets the eighth seed in the West, which is really the only place that is up for grabs. But look, we know in this league, you know, seventh and eighth seeds are cannon fodder in the first round. It's, you know, this is all being playing, you know, for the right to get knocked out by LeBron in the first round. And look, there's still something at stake because, you know, the Trailblazers are a pretty good team when they're whole. And if they have Nurkic and Collins back, hey, maybe they give the Lakers, you know, a big push in the first round there, or at least, you know, might wear them down for further opponents after that. It could still be significant. The other thing, of course, is that some of the standing spots are still up for grabs. Like, you know, in the West especially, like these teams could still go up or down in the seedings. And that matters too, of course, just for matchups.
For sure, for sure. A lot there to consider. And I'm imagining a Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum, Carmelo Anthony, and then you mentioned Collins and Nurkic possibly returning. Imagine that matchup in the first round with the Lakers, who, unfortunately for them, they were playing their best ball of the season before this happened, and they've got to get that engine going again. So as we know, anything can happen. Usually ones and twos are take care of business, but we've seen crazier things happen before. And as you've mentioned multiple times, this is completely unprecedented, and it's going to be unlike anything we've ever seen. So here's to hoping they figure it out safely and strategically, and it would be great to have some basketball back, but only under the right circumstances. So pivoting here, as I love to say, both on the low post, on the block, and on our show, it's hard to believe, Howard Beck, that 20 years ago, I was fresh out of college. BJ was finishing up his NBA career. And you were smack in the middle of covering the Los Angeles Lakers. And I can't describe enough how thrilling it was to read your recent oral history on the Portland Trailblazers, Los Angeles Lakers, Game 7, Kobe to Shaq lob moment, which I was so happy to find all of the voices, all of the context around it, because it's not just the play, it's everything that led up to the play and all of those incredible characters on those teams. Before we get into some of the nitty gritty, when you sat down to do this, what was the strategy in that basketball brain of yours?
Well, thanks for the kind words on it all. That was like a passion project. I've been wanting to write this one for years, and it was one of my favorite games, that Game 7, one of my favorite moments, the lob from Kobe to Shaq, and one of my favorite series that I've ever covered, maybe the best of series I've ever covered. My thought was the lob itself is what everybody remembers, and what people forget is that the lob, it didn't win the game. It wasn't a go-ahead basket. It wasn't decisive. It was kind of the final dagger, but it was it really represents, one, this clinching of a partnership between Kobe and Shaq in a very critical moment, the moment that truly launched the dynasty. But it also was the punctuation mark on a comeback from 15 points down in the fourth quarter of a Game 7, which at the time was the biggest fourth quarter comeback, I think. I don't know if it was in conference finals history or just Game 7 history, but that was huge. And 15 points back then was a lot. So, you know, there's just so many layers to this. And then the other piece of it broadly was that this was this ultimate sliding doors moment, because if the Blazers had won, and maybe they should have, there may be no Laker dynasty to speak of. Maybe Shaq and Kobe win only one title in 3 years, or maybe they win zero. You know, they're the third year of the three-peat. They were also in a Game 7 of the conference finals, overtime even. And that one was on the road at Sacramento. And so, you know, it's these thin margins that sometimes define teams and eras, and the difference between a dynasty and a non-dynasty, or a disappointment, in fact, is a couple of plays, a couple of minutes of basketball spread over the course of a few years. And so that – those things are always fascinating to me. And so I always wanted to do this, to revisit this moment. And I knew that to do it right, I wanted to hit all those layers that I just mentioned. And I knew to do it right, I needed to get, you know, just as many voices as I could. And not everyone is easily available. I would have loved to talk to Rasheed Wallace. But as we know, Rashid is not the most, you know, media friendly of basketball figures. And I say that with all respect, like it's fine. Like it's, he has no obligation. He certainly has no obligation now. Bonzi Wells, who I had a great conversation with for this story, Bonzi said he would ask Rashid for me. So I appreciate Bonzi's efforts, but Bonzi could not quite convince Rashid to chat. But I got five players from each team. And the, you know, they were all rotation players. It was all, you know, important guys, you know, getting Shaq obviously was key on the Lakers side, Rick Fox, Robert Horry, Derek Fisher, Brian Shaw. I emailed a little bit with Phil Jackson. Phil was, you know, decided he didn't want to go full bore on this one, which is fine. I got Mike Dunleavy, you know, obviously who coached the Blazers. Scottie Pippen was huge. Bonzi was fantastic. Damon Stoudemire, Greg Anthony, Steve Smith. And so I think that was able, with all those voices, I could paint the fullest possible picture of how these teams viewed each other, of what that moment meant for all of them. And it was just, it was so much fun to do. It was great. I'm glad people enjoyed it.
And Howard, from your perspective, you know, and speaking with everyone, I'm just watching that series as a casual fan. What was the turning point? Because the Lakers were up, 3-1 in the series?
Yeah, the Lakers were up 3-1 in the series. So the thing about the Lakers back then, especially that first year, you know, they won 67 games and they won the championship. So I think people just think, oh, well, of course, you know, there was this dominant team. They were like the Warriors, just like smashing everybody on the way to the title or something. And it just wasn't the case. They won 67 games in the regular season, but that was a surprise. Nobody saw that coming, even their first year under Phil Jackson. And when they got to the playoffs, sure, they entered as the favorites at that moment. But before the season started, they weren't even viewed as the favorites. The Spurs were considered the favorites to repeat as champs. The Blazers were picked by a lot of people ahead of the Lakers. The LA Times had the Lakers fifth in the West before the season started. And so they came together much faster and acclimated to the triangle much faster than anybody anticipated. But they get to the playoffs. And here they are, this swaggering team with Shaq, who's, you know, the most dominant player in the game. He just won the MVP that year, nearly unanimously, should have been unanimously. Kobe is only 21, but he's already an all-star. They've got some good role players, although people at that time weren't sure about those guys. And they go up to the best of five first round back then. They go up 2-0 on the eighth seeded Sacramento Kings, who are not the powerhouse Kings yet. They're just the eighth seed. The Lakers are up 2-0 on them, and they lose the next two in a row in Sacramento, and now they've got to face a life-or-death game five against an eighth seed, flirting with disaster. Now, I think, if I recall, they blew them out that game, but still, they let it get there. They go to the second round. They go up 3-0 on the Phoenix Suns, and then they lose game four by double digits and just were never even in it at all. They close it out in five. They were never really in danger, but still. They're flirting with disaster. They just didn't know how to deal with success. And so it was just the same thing when they got to the conference finals. They split the first two games. The Blazers won game two at Staples Center to steal home court advantage. Lakers get it back. They're up 3-1, and then they lose the next two in a row, including losing another game at Staples Center in game five. So it's, and, you know, the whys and the hows, well, because the Blazers were really good. Like, it wasn't some specific aspect of X's and O's or execution specifically. It was more about, to me, the Blazers were just really good at the right spots, right? Like, they had multiple guys who could make Kobe really work at both ends. Scottie Pippen, Steve Smith, Bonzi Wells, these are all physical wings who could put, you know, take Kobe down to the block, who could make him really work on offense for his shots. And not many teams had that kind of arsenal to throw at him. And then Arvydas Sabonis was one of the few guys who actually was as big and powerful as Shaq. Now, he was not as nimble as Shaq, so that was a problem. But Sabonis could certainly stand up to him, and he had three-point shooting range, so he could pull Shaq out of the paint. And then they had, you know, a wealth of bigs, you know, in Rashid and Brian Grant and a young Jermaine O'Neal. So it just, they presented pretty big challenges, and they were a veteran team. And so they gave the Lakers all they could handle.
That team was so good and has become so forgotten. And Howard, you covered it. BJ, you played against so many of these guys. Can we just talk for a minute
about how good, first off, Steve Smith was and for how long. And that game seven, he is lighting the Lakers up until the momentum turns. BJ, what kind of player was Steve Smith to like to deal with?
Well, people don't recall, you know, Steve is from Detroit. And so I've been knowing Steve since he was a young man, watching him grow up and going to Michigan State, coming to the league. And when he first came in the league, people forget, they thought he was a point guard. And Steve always had a great feel for the game, and his game advanced. And what I mean by that is he began to explore the post, utilize his height, because he was, you know, 6'7" or so, six, probably bigger than that. And he had a great feel for the game. So when you watch and, you know, as you play and you go, you advance in the playoffs, you know, size does matter, especially at the guard position. And Steve was a very capable scorer, as, you know, as you just alluded to. And then all of a sudden you throw in his ability to initiate the offense and take over some of the point guard duties, along with another big guard and Scottie Pippen and Bonzi Wells and all of those guys. And suddenly now you have a problem, because those are three, you know, they all bring something unique to the game. So, but Steve Smith was an incredible player, had an amazing career. And, you know, I think he won a championship there in San Antonio, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
In San Antonio. So he was more than a capable player and provided many problems for many years that I had an opportunity to play against him professionally. And, but, you know, that's nothing new to us. We've been watching Steve since, you know, his days back in Detroit growing up, and it was incredible to watch.
And Howard, you look at how I connected with Bonzi back in the fall. He came by one of our All the Smoke tapings, and we've been in touch a lot since, and it got me back into how that team was constructed. And they get Steve Smith by trading J.R. Ryder, and they bring Pippen in after his first year in Houston doesn't work out, after the Bulls are broken up. You talk about it in your oral history, where if the Blazers win that game, they've got a very good chance to win a championship, and they don't make some of the moves that are made that offseason, which of course is, correct me if I'm wrong, it's Brian Grant is gone, Jermaine O'Neal is gone, Sean Kemp and Dale Davis brought in. You combine that with the fact that the East's finals representatives the next few years are not exactly all-time great teams that we think about. What could have this Blazers team been if that fourth quarter goes another way?
Well, according to Steve Smith, they get the three-peat. So now the Lakers disagreed a little bit when I put that to them. Smitty was one of my first interviews, so I got to parade his quotes to all the Lakers once I talked to them. But Smitty said, he was smiling, but it was not entirely in jest. But and also he's not wrong. Like, they had the potential to do that. They were stacked enough. They were talented enough. Now, they had some age issues. You know, Scottie had a lot of miles on him. Sabonis was 35 and had obviously a lot of miles on him, and had come to the NBA late in his career, as we know. Detlef Schrempf was on that team, was part of the rotation, and was up there in years. Smitty still had some good years left. But they had a young Jermaine O'Neal, and they had Brian Grant, and so they had this depth. And Rasheed was a beast. This is one of the stories that I couldn't really get into, or one of the, you know, layers or tangents that I couldn't explore as much in this story, because there's just only so much room. But Rasheed was as talented to me as any of the other power forwards of that era. Yes, I'm saying that he was as talented as Garnett and Duncan and Chris Webber and all the rest. If he wanted to be that kind of player with the gaudy numbers, he could have been. It's not the way he was built. It's not the way he played. But the dude was amazing. Inside game, outside game, ball handling skills, incredibly smart, great defender. And so that team, if they win, you're not flipping a disgruntled Jermaine O'Neal for an older Dale Davis, who is, you know, while a fine player, Dale Davis did not have, obviously, the, you know, where the broad game, the diverse game, the skill set, and also the youth, of course, that Jermaine O'Neal had. And they traded Brian Grant, who had a, you know, had contract demands that they didn't want to meet, as was his right. and they sign and trade him in a deal that brings them back a, you know, older, overweight, and still troubled Sean Kemp, who ends up, I think, playing one season before he has to go into rehab for drugs. So it really hurts them making those moves. And if you win the championship, you're more inclined to spend. You're more inclined to want to keep together a good thing and not mess with chemistry. And so who knows? If they keep those guys together, now Sabonis starts to age out. Okay, great. Jermaine O'Neal has been dying to get those minutes. Now he's getting those minutes. And, you know, they could have kept, replenishing along the edges or around the edges along the way. And, yeah, I think they would have beaten the Pacers in year one. Year two of the Laker three-peat was against the Sixers. That team was not very good. I think the Blazers, again, if they make it back to the finals, they could have won that one, and they certainly could have won year three against the New Jersey Nets, who the Lakers swept. So, you know, I mean, it's hard to map out the whole counterfactual, because, you know, how good would the Lakers have been? How many changes would they have made? Would they have screwed up their chemistry that they were building by jettisoning Ori and Fox and Fisher or these guys? Where would the Spurs be in this whole thing? The Kings are rising along the way. So there's no guarantee the Blazers would have won three, but they definitely would have had one.
Yeah, and you mentioned those other teams. Just think about, like, the Western Conference playoffs back then obviously were some great matchups. It would have elevated it even more if the Blazers had kept it together. Yep. And I think about a young, evolving Jermaine O'Neal playing next to Rasheed Wallace. And that's just flat out frightening to think about.
BJ, am I wrong on Rasheed?
Well, I'll say this about Rasheed. In playing in that era and watching these guys, Rasheed was gifted. You know, we talk about players who are talented. You know, Rasheed had all of the gifts. And without question, you know, Rasheed was one of those players at any given moment that could really take over a game just with his talent. You know, we talk about offensively what he could do. Defensively, he could block shots. He could play, be a rim protector. He was a great interior defender, and he was athletic as any. So, you know, you're talking about the great players of that era at the power forward position when that was a monster position, right? You had, you know, you had Tim Duncan. You know, you had Kevin Garnett. You know, you had, Karl Malone was still there. You had all of these players, and without hesitation, Rasheed Wallace could play the game at the highest level. And I think that's what made him such a unique player, is because Rasheed Wallace could take over a game. You know, he had that turnaround jump shot on the box that was just really unguardable. And he was a phenomenal, phenomenal player. And, you know, that was a great team. It was a unique team. And I'm talking about the Portland Trail Blazers, just because Scottie Pippen, what he brought, you know, he brought a championship swagger to that group. And clearly he knew how to manage a game. So I thought that was a very unique opportunity for them. But without question, if they were going to really do this and sustain it, it was going to be led by Rasheed Wallace, because Rasheed Wallace, that's a guy you could throw the ball to. And he could carry a team just because he had an unguardable shot. I mean, his turnaround jump shot was just truly unguardable. And I didn't care who was playing against it. And he was every bit, I mean, I know he listed at 6'10 or 6'11, but he was every bit 7 feet. And he was one of the great talents that we've seen in this league in many years. And, you know, he goes on to Detroit and, you know, playing alongside Ben Wallace and those guards that they had there, you could see that he was clearly the X factor of propelling the Pistons to when they won there in Detroit. So he's that type of player. He was that type of player.
Hey Howard, last one for you. You know, obviously the season always culminates in the NBA finals, and we've seen so many incredible matchups and moments. And I think along the way, people get lost in some of the great conference finals. People just forget as time goes by. And it's one thing we're going to be highlighting here as we move hopefully towards the return of the NBA into these summer months. Can you frame up this conference finals in terms of the last, you know, couple of decades, whether it's the last, you know, maybe since the beginning of the Bird Magic era, which obviously you're a student of,
and along with how long you've been covering the game, just how great of a series this was, along with the domino effect it created due to the result?
Yeah, well, you know, clearly, as we've discussed, it does change history. It certainly changes history because it does launch the Shaq Kobe dynasty. It does snuff out what was potentially a perpetual powerhouse in Portland. The Lakers end up sweeping them the next 2 years in the first round, both years, 3-0, 3-0. And so it's really just they go from being one of the best teams in the league to just being an afterthought very quickly. And so there's that impact. There's the way it affected the Lakers. There's the way, obviously there's a lot of other ripples from there. In terms of that series and conference finals, at least, you know, ones that I've covered, I mean, that one and the 7-game series against the Kings two years later were two of the best series, two of the most intense that I've ever covered. And, you know, trying to flash forward, I mean, I'm thinking about other series. You know, it's different when you're not the beat writer. You know, mm-hmm. I've covered other series. I've parachuted in and out of series where I'm not there from start to finish. Because these days as a national writer, you're just not there plugged in all the time. It's just different when you feel it up close, when you know these guys from being around them every single day for an entire season or 7 years as I was there. You feel it differently because you understand the team at a different level than when you're just parachuting in from the outside. And so I don't know what I would compare that series to other than the 7-gamer against the Kings 2 years later, but those were two of the most memorable of all time for me as someone, you know, covering it up close and there for every minute of it. And, you know, there've been plenty of great series since, obviously some of those Spurs Heat moments in the finals and, Warriors, Cavs.
Yeah, did you cover Thunder Warriors at all in 16 when the 73 win Warriors came back from 3-1 down?
Did not. I can't remember where I was that week or what I was working on, but no, I did not cover that series.
Yeah, that was a heck of a conference finals series. This was great, man. This was great. BJ, anything else to throw at our guy?
Hey, ours the best. Guy, I've seen it all. He's covered and great job, and I appreciate you for coming on.
No, thanks, guys. This was fun. Thanks for having me.
Sure. We'll talk soon, buddy. Thank you.
Take care.
Great to reflect back on that classic series and what it meant to those two franchises. In the next couple of months, we'll be reliving some of the great conference finals in the last 40 years. Celtics Sixers in 81, Bulls Pacers in 98, Cavs Pistons in 07, just to name a few. We're really looking forward to those conversations. Basketball action has been paused, but the Pure Hoops lineup has continued to go on. Be sure to check out the Mike Wise Show each and every Monday with his esteemed guests. On Tuesday, it's the Full Court Press with Fanta and Adams. Wednesday features Catch and Shoot 2.0 with Aaron Berlin and Otto Strong. Thursdays, Buckets, Boards, and Blocks with the one and only Monica McNutt. And the Pure Hoops podcast each and every Friday with BJ Armstrong and yours truly, Eric Newman. Have a great weekend. Stay safe, stay healthy, stay pure.
The Pure Hoops podcast is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.